From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. As North Carolina legislators begin a new long session in Raleigh, both political parties have pointed to education as an area needing attention. The first day of the session, Republican lawmakers filed a bill in the House to address class sizes. That's because last year, a newly passed law reduced maximum class size but came with no additional state funding. That left some school systems looking down the barrel of cutting in other areas, such as arts and physical education. That will be addressed this session, and Democratic Governor Roy Cooper has listed education, particularly teacher pay, as one of his top priorities this year. That's the larger mainstream vantage point for public schools in North Carolina. Special education has been around for decades, and it's come a long way. A child with autism or dyslexia will have a very different experience in school today than they might have had even a few years ago. But what is the state's mandate in that regard? In Colorado, one family sued its school district for the cost of sending their son, who has autism, to a private school where they provide ABA therapy. The family lost the lower court ruling, but the case will now be heard before the U.S. Supreme Court, according to a report published in The Atlantic. On this edition of Coastline, we have two experts in the field to explain how special education has changed over the years, emerging technologies that are making their way to the classroom, and the challenges educators still face. Amelia Moody is an associate professor in early childhood and special education at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She also directs the Center for Assistive Technology there. Amelia Moody, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you.
Also with us today is Bethany Ney. She works in the New Hanover County Public School System at Holly Tree Elementary, where she is a special education teacher in intensive social communication support, level 2. She was recently recognized by the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction as New Hanover County's 2016 Exceptional Children's Teacher of Excellence. Bethany Ney, welcome to the program and congratulations.
Thank you.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation if you have a question for either of our experts on special education in this region. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Bethany Ney, just so people who are not familiar with special education and how it works today and here in southeastern North Carolina, when a family discovers that they have a child who will have a special educational need, what do they do if they want their child to go to a public school? How does the process work?
There are lots of opportunities for parents to reach out for early intervention as young as 2 years old through the CDC. But even in coming into, if a school-age child that they're concerned, coming in to request an evaluation, the school system would start that process with the family and come alongside with them to do appropriate evaluations or complete appropriate evaluations in order to see if the child is eligible for an individualized education plan. And then through that, the school would implement that plan for them so that the child could be most successful.
And how do you create an individualized education plan?
After evaluations are completed and the child's results were to indicate specially designed instruction at whichever level that child would need, then the IEP team would come together, which would be the parents, and then the we have special education liaisons, the special education teacher would come in together, and any related services that the child might would demonstrate a need for, and together would write the plan based on the child's present levels and then goals and objectives to help them grow to where you would want them to be.
And so once you've established this individual educational plan, the IEP,
yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Then the school system, the school district, has essentially committed to carrying that out. What are the mandates for public schools in terms of
what they must provide for kids with special needs versus what parents might want. What happens when a parent's desire for his child or her child comes up against what the school is willing to provide?
At that point, if the team is not able to come to a consensus, the parent is able to appeal the recommendation, and then they would enter into mediation. The goal is for the school, and the parent is very much a part of the team, as the school is. It's not the school telling the parent. It's working together for the child and implementing the best practices for them to be most successful. If that consensus does not happen in the meeting, then the parent would reach out for mediation, and then from there the process would continue to be evaluated to hopefully come together with a decision that would be in the best interest of the child and the most realistic that the school system could implement with fidelity.
And that's a good point. We're actually going to get to what's realistic and what's not, particularly where ABA therapy comes in, because we've gotten questions before about that particular methodology for children who have autism. But Amelia Moody, can you give us kind of an overview of how the field of special education has changed over the last couple of decades in public school systems? What's different today than for kids who might have been in the public school system, say, 20 years ago?
Well, the whole reason that we have special education is historically people were not allowed to have a free and appropriate education in schools. And so laws and policies have been developed to try to protect the rights of children and their families. And so with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act that was authorized in 2007 and reauthorized in, 1997 and reauthorized in 2004, we make sure that students are unbiasedly assessed, that they get a free and appropriate public education, and that they're educated in the least restrictive environment to ensure that they have more access to their peers and the education that most students would get.
And so can you give us an example? Let's say a child 20 years ago who had autism went into the public school system. How different would that child's experience be versus today? I mean, what resources are available for that child today that wouldn't have been there?
So there are cases where students were not educated in the least restrictive environment. There were cases where parents, the process was slow to occur. So there are mandates of how quickly you have to, each step of the process has to take place so that it can't be delayed and students are getting services quickly. So there have been some changes to make services better for those families. And there are rights that are in place for parents so that their rights are protected and they know what they are if they decide that what's happening in the schools are unfair.
What are some of the newer technologies or methodologies that you might use with a child with autism that didn't exist a few years ago?
So there's different therapies and procedures. Most cutting-edge sort of innovative technologies that are happening right now is they're embedding interventions within software, because we know that students with autism are very drawn to technology. And so we're seeing a lot of programs that incorporate the instruction so they can practice on their own. We're also seeing the use of robotics a lot more. There's a new push to try to integrate STEM education into special education. And so Lego Mindstorm robots and humanoid robots are starting to be investigated to see their effectiveness.
Okay, sort of a side question here. If I'm in a traditional mainstream classroom and I see some of my peers in a special education classroom playing with Legos, I'm going to get jealous if that's the way I learn math. Is that something that could spill over into traditional classroom situations?
They're there. They are there. Some of the more expensive technologies are still being researched, and they have to be a much less expensive in order for them to appear in schools. But many of these technologies are available for loan, so that's not costing the schools money. So we have a Center for STEM at UNCW on campus where teachers can check out technology and use it for free. And we have assistive technology centers where you can come in and try out products specifically designed for people with disabilities. and use them.
And can you just give us the range when you talk about assistive technologies? What does that cover? It's a pretty broad range of stuff.
Yeah, and Bethany, you're welcome to join me on this. Use of Velcro for a picture schedule. So a student has a visual representation of the schedule of the day can help children with autism. That's a very low-tech solution, whereas using a humanoid robot that costs $10,000 would be a very high-tech solution. And in between, there's softwares that they use. So word prediction software, if you're typing a sentence, it guesses what the sentence might be that you're typing or the word and predicts it. There's dictionary functions that you can look up words to give you vocabulary understandings that you didn't have before.
And quick question, just a minute or so before we go to break. Well, of course, we've heard in national news, Betsy DeVos just went through some Senate confirmation hearings last week. She is Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of Education. She believes special education rights should be decided by the state. Amelia Moody, should this be federally mandated, or is a state-by-state kind of decision-making process a better option? Do you have a position on that?
I think we have federal policies that guide us, and we also have state decisions that can be made, but those decisions have to be made mindfully. There are some cases where there are states that have decided procedures that have gone against federal policy.
And you also were telling me that there are some places where folks can go to find out about some of her positions on specific issues, drilling down a little bit.
Yes, the Council for Exceptional Children has put forth a policy statement on what to look for, a position statement, and so has the educational associations. Most of them have put forth a position statement.
And we'll put that up on our website with this show also if folks are looking for that. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're exploring the evolution of the field of special education with Bethany Ney, a special ed teacher in the New Hanover County Public School System, and Amelia Moody, an associate professor in early childhood and special education at UNCW. Give us a call, 910-343-1138, or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking today about special education in our region with Associate Professor in Early Childhood and Special Education, Amelia Moody. She's at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where she also directs the Center for Assistive Technology. And Bethany Ney is a special education teacher at Holly Tree Elementary in New Hanover County in Intensive Social Communication Support Level 2. And our guests are taking your questions on this Thursday. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And we had a question. Mike from Wilmington called. This is a good question. He asks, is there a change in language on the horizon? The way we talk about things affects the way we perceive them. What about inclusive education instead of special education? Bethany?
I do think the terminologies in special education are constantly shifting to be most appropriate, to make sure that we're reflecting what we're truly implementing for our students to be most successful. Inclusive education is an excellent term, but for me, I also think about our students who their access to the most appropriate and their least restrictive environment may not be included in the general education classroom. Yet for them, that's where they're most successful, is being separate. The students that I teach are in a separate special education classroom, and while they certainly have access to their general education classroom as they show readiness, in that it's a beneficial opportunity for them to grow academically, behaviorally, socially. For them, inclusive situations or settings is not always most optimal. So while that's definitely what we strive for because we want to accept all and include all, I think to finding the appropriate terms, that phrase that would cover all is almost impossible to some degree. But I do think it's important that we always choose our language to describe special education that it sounds the most positive, because that's what it is. It's meant to be a positive experience and for our students to be enriched, whether that's inclusive in their general education classroom or inclusive but separate in their own special education classroom with their peers that are on their level. If that answered, I hope
That makes a lot of sense. And UNCW's Amelia Moody, talk about language around this issue a little bit, because there's a distinction today. We would say a child who has autism, is that right, versus an autistic child?
Yes, and we refer to that as person first language, so the person comes before the disability. But I agree with Bethany in that we have a least restrictive environment for a reason, and that is our goal is to get our kids into an inclusive classroom and so that they can function with their peers. That's our dream. But if they're not ready and they can learn best in a different setting, we want those options available to our students because their education is very important to us.
And I don't know, but I'm guessing that Mike might have been referring to the notion that years ago there was something of a stigma surrounding that term. You know, are kids kinder today than they were even a few years ago? Are people more aware and sensitive about that? Or do kids, because there was a time
Absolutely.
When a kid who was in special education would be a target for pretty vicious ridicule from other kids and sometimes even parents. Has that changed, Bethany Nay?
I would say absolutely. I think we continue to see the benefits of exposing all of our students in our schools to diverse learners, whether that's special education or just a student that's in the general education classroom but needs a little bit of a different strategy in order to learn. And I think we've seen a lot of the benefits of our students that with special needs have an exposure to their peer models. And thinking about least restrictive, and when we do meet with parents and we start developing their IEP to be the most appropriate, we want to think about the general education accessing from their general ed class first, and then we kind of break it down from there to see. But least restrictive, taking a student and putting them in their general education classroom and then having them need an adult one-on-one or supports that are actually more restrictive than if they were in a specialized special education classroom that allowed them to have more independence and freedom to grow and learn. And then, of course, as they show the ability to mainstream and be more inclusive, we would do that. So I think it's just thinking about what least restrictive looks for that specific student. Every child's different. But I think absolutely we're more accepting and seeing that most of the children now, especially at the elementary level, they don't know if the child has special needs or not. They're all students in the school. They all are learning, and, you know, they all access the instruction that the school offers. And they may see differences, but not it's not a negative stigma.
Do teachers talk to mainstream kids, kids who are in the traditional classroom setting, about other children who have these individualized education programs? I mean, are they educated about
yes,
that?
Yes, absolutely. And I think we as special educators have evolved as well to be an advocate, a voice for our students, not just for the other children. Most of the time, our young children are much more accepting and may not even see the differences that we as adults would notice more quickly. So I think the special education teacher's job is to also educate fellow teachers and colleagues on how they can have these students to be most successful and then how their students in their classroom can be a leader to pull our students in so that they truly feel included, because they are. They're all part of the learning environment in some capacity.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking today about special education, what's available in public schools, what emerging technologies show promise, and what we've learned over the last several decades about this field. Our guests today, Bethany Nay, a special education teacher in intensive social communication supports at Holly Tree Elementary. She was named New Hanover County's 2016 Exceptional Children's Teacher of Excellence by the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction. and Associate Professor Amelia Moody of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She teaches early childhood and special education and is the director of the Center for Assistive Technology on campus. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Mary Lee from Leland, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say that I'm an older student, and I had Amelia as my teacher a few years ago, and I thank her for all her work. We are raising our grandson who has PTSD, depression, anger issues from his neglect and abandonment by his parents, and we had him in the public schools, and they had an IEP. We had an IEP, but it just didn't work very well. So we had got a grant through the state, and he's now in a non-public private school, and there's no help. He's struggling there, too. They're accepting him and keeping him, but there's no public help. We're looking for private help. I'm just wondering about that.
That's a really good question, Mary Lee. Amelia Moody, what? Any advice for her? And Mary, can I ask, is this Brunswick County Schools?
Yes.
Okay.
That's a challenge. I think that there are these federal mandates that are in place, but the more that you seek out schools that are not held to those laws, it becomes challenging. So if you are in a public school and you're not getting served in the way that you wish you were, and it's not assisting a child, what I would do is I would call an IEP meeting, which a family can do at any time, and pull the group together and try to problem solve within the system to make sure that your student is getting what they need. I think the fact that some families have resources to go out into the community and find private support is very wonderful, but many don't. And therefore, using the process and the system and the laws and the protections that are provided to people is important. But I know, you know, having a child with a special need is very challenging at times. And parents are, you know, such troopers and incredible for taking on these kids. And I was a foster parent, and you just love your kids and you want what's best for them. So it's a very difficult situation.
Bethany Nay.
I was just going to say, parents also have access to parent advocates. I do not personally have a child with special needs, but I've been teaching in this field for a long time. And when I sit in meetings with parents, it's easy for them to feel like it's the parent versus the team. And I think more than anything, for me professionally, making sure that parent understands that we want to all work together. But there are also parent advocates that can come in with that parent to help them to ask the correct questions. It's very complicated, the wording, the paperwork, sort of all the little things that you do have to put in place to make sure you're following through with all those guidelines. For a parent, sometimes that's very overwhelming. And so there are access to parent advocates that can kind of help come alongside that parent to ask the correct questions.
Where would someone like Mary find a parent advocate? Is that a legal person? Is it someone with the Department of Social Services? Who is that?
Within our county, through the Autism Society, they have parent advocates. Are there other?
Yeah, and it can really be anyone that is willing to come in and help support.
Yeah. It doesn't have to
a student. So I would look for the resources. People that have worked with your student can come in and share what's happening at home. Anyone who's supporting a child at home can come in. And resources in your local universities and colleges and schools, I think, are important to reach out and try to find that assistance, because when you're in it, it's hard to see
the big
picture and how to get out of that place. And calling on your community, I mean, it really is. We are a community. We're here. We're special educators. We do it mostly because we love it and we love our students. And so we want parents to succeed and be happy, and children to reach their best potential.
Mary, can you speak a little bit to what it was like to go back to the IEP team and reach the conclusion that this wasn't going to work for your grandson? How did that fall apart?
I think it was the mainstream teacher. He was doing well in the special ed section, and then he's very bright. He has a very high IQ, and his processing skills are normal. So it's very difficult for him to do fine motor work and little detailed work. He wanted big ideas. He wanted to read. So in the special ed classroom, he thrived, but he really was academically able to be in the regular class. So the teacher in the regular ed was not supportive, was not knowledgeable, was not able to control the classroom. And then it became sort of a battle with the school versus us. We did have parent advocates. They weren't very welcoming to have our parent advocates come in. And it seemed like we were on the road to him being ostracized. And I found this grant, and I feel that was probably the best thing to do, to seek to use that money to pay for a private school.
Amelia Moody, any final words for Mary?
I would say if you're feeling like that road is not meeting his needs, then maybe possibly revisit the option of going back to the school system and requesting some of the things that were not in place that you feel could help your son.
Is that at all helpful, Mary?
Well, I'm wondering about now that he's in a non-public school, what support is there for him?
This is where we get into difficult territory because it really does depend on the school and the area and the services. So that would be hard for me to answer right now specifically.
Mary, if you could call back, and our producer, Isabel Shepherd, will take your name and number, and we'll see if we can explore some other avenues to get you some help.
Oh, wonderful.
Thank you so much for that call. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about special education today, what's available in public schools, what emerging technologies are out there, and you can ask your own question of our guests today. We have Associate Professor Amelia Moody of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where she teaches early childhood and special education, and she's the director for the Center of Assistive Technology on campus. Bethany Ney is a special education teacher in Intensive Social Communication Supports Level 2 at Holly Tree Elementary School in New Hanover County. And we have Kathy from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask if you could speak a little bit about the benefits for the general ed population of having the special education, not just the children and the families, but the teaching team there. A minute ago, you were talking about the cultural and social aspects and benefits for kids getting to know each other. But I also wanted to ask if you could just explain about how it benefits the general population to have the expertise of the special ed team there.
Amelia Moody.
I'm not sure I understand your question. So you're asking how having a general ed student involved?
Well, Dr. Moody, this is, I work with you at UNCW.
Oh, great.
And I wanted to make sure that the general ed population realizes that to me, I would say it's a big benefit having at a school the special ed team there because of early identification and being able to help the general population also with kids who haven't yet been identified, but helping them to make modifications. If you could talk a little bit about that, I think people a lot of times don't realize what a benefit that is.
Okay.
Great point.
So, Amelia, since she asked you that question first, do you want to take it and then we'll go to Bethany?
Sure. So I do think that just having general educators need special educators and special educators need general educators, and we both kind of have to work together to make sure that students get to where they need. That's a wonderful point. And consultation is available for some students. So if a teacher is struggling and we want someone to come in and provide some tools in a toolbox to sort of try out to try to remediate some of those situations before they come to a place where they need to be possibly placed in and evaluated for special education.
Bethany Ney.
I think it's excellent to bring up this topic because I do think that our general education teachers are naturally becoming more more experts in differentiation. And so as we incorporate more differentiation, a lot of our students with special needs are able to access their instruction in their general education classroom just because within that classroom there's more differentiation so that they can learn the different skills in different ways. And when you do the collaborative inclusive opportunities where you have the special education teacher in the classroom, I think, like Ms. Moody had said, the teacher, general education teacher and special education teacher work together, and through different reflective conversations and collaboration, they come up with ideas that may work for one child with special needs, but also for some of our students who may be struggling with more intense interventions but are not yet or may not ever need access to fully special education, but are able to grow with those interventions.
And just to link that back to our earlier conversation, that is a new trend in special education within the past 5-10 years, that we're seeing a lot more collaboration between general and special educators trying to serve children in the general education setting before they have to move.
Absolutely.
Kathy, thank you so much for that phone call. And zooming back even more, we have just a couple of minutes before we go to break. But aside from the moral or ethical or legal mandate to serve a child with special needs in a public school system, it's not necessarily an altruistic idea. It's a selfish idea for a culture, because if that child isn't served well as a child, what are the implications, Amelia Moody, later? For the society, for that community?
Well, we know that early intervention is much less expensive. So we know that if children get help when they're younger, that their chances of catching up with their peers and being more successful increase, and that decreases the cost later on. So we know financially there's a benefit. And we also know there's decreased rates in prison, and there's more higher employment rates. So early intervention is linked to better outcomes. And so getting intervention early is very important.
You're listening to Coastline on HQR News 91.3 FM. It's an exploration of special education in southeastern North Carolina. When we come back from this 90-second break, you'll have one more segment to call in with your question or comment on this Thursday. Do you have a relative or a friend who has a learning disability? Have you always wanted to ask an expert about the challenges you face with your child? You can reach us today at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're learning about special education options, challenges, and emerging technologies. With us to answer your question on this Thursday, Bethany Ney is a special education teacher in intensive social communication supports, level 2, at Holly Tree Elementary School in New Hanover County. And she was also recently named New Hanover County's Exceptional Children's Teacher of Excellence by the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction. Amelia Moody is an associate professor of early childhood and special education at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, where she also directs the Center for Assistive Technology. You have a few minutes left today to ask your question on this Thursday. Our phone number is 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And just before we went to break, Dr. Moody, you were talking about how we know at this point that early intervention for kids is less costly in the long run. It can, say, stop someone who might have wound up in prison if they hadn't gotten some special education. But you have a personal story about this.
Sure. Well, I was diagnosed with a learning disability in third grade because I wasn't learning to read. But I was also – I'm considered twice exceptional, so I was also gifted. And so throughout my schooling, I had to get very intensive intervention for a few years there, and now I've come a long way, and you learn coping mechanisms to try to handle the challenges that you face. They don't disappear, so I still have dyslexia, but I've managed to be successful in school and in life because of very hard work, frankly, and very high, great teachers.
And do you think that it took longer for the adults around you to figure out that you had dyslexia because you were so bright?
I was in a unique situation where my IQ was taken when I was very young, and so that was back when we used a discrepancy model, so they could look at your IQ and look how you were performing and see the difference. And so I started performing on grade level, which was different than all of my other peers, and so they had to start looking at how I was performing and the fact that I wasn't learning phonological awareness and learning to read like all the other students were. And so they were able to identify me.
And are there strategies that you use now? If, for instance, if you were working with a child who had dyslexia today, are there strategies that you would teach this child that maybe you didn't have when you were in school?
Sure. So as research grows, the field, we research new evidence-based services. So like today, video modeling, not necessarily for dyslexia, but for autism, is a very well-known therapy or intervention that we know that works. And so as researchers continue to just add new tools and interventions, and we research them, and we get an aggregation of research, so just not one study, but multiple studies, and we know something works, then that can be implemented in schools to assist people in improving. So I've seen growth in every area and disability category when it comes to research.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today about special education with UNCW's Amelia Moody and New Hanover County Schools' Bethany Ney. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by giving us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Marty from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a speech therapist, and I've done quite years of work in the schools. And my comment was that I believe a lot of the tension that occurs at times between parents and staff, exceptional children staff and classroom teachers, is related to a lack of resources. By law, we are required to provide an appropriate individualized education to students that have, you know, a lot of needs. But in fact, we have limited money for materials and staff and so forth. So one child can require quite a lot of need or resources from a teacher and for particular materials. But we cannot say, we don't have the money for that, or we don't have the time for that.
So what do you do, Marty? Can you give us a specific example of a situation where you didn't have the resources for a child, and you had to somehow find a way to make it happen?
Well, there are times when parents have wanted say a child to stay mainstreamed into a classroom, and that child is autistic and has a lot of behavioral needs. Now, what that would mean is having maybe one staff member devoted to that child to help that child stay on task, not to distract that child from the other students in the class, and to provide that child with extra one-on-one help. So that is one entire salary devoted to a single child when the Exceptional Children's Department has very limited funds. So it's difficult as a special educator because you can't say, we can't do that. You know, when in fact you may believe that would be a great thing. I think that's what that child needs. So then what you have is parents who feel like, you know, we're trying to, you know, they don't care about my child, or they don't want to do what's best for my child. Also, in terms of how many hours a week, as a speech therapist, I have a whole lot of children on my caseload, but I can't see a particular child, say, every day. It just isn't going to happen. And what happens is if some parents push more than other parents. They may get more for their child, but in fact, it's also taking from other children. So it's a really difficult situation.
Marty, thank you so much for your call. Bethany Ney, how do you walk that tightrope between providing resources to a child and making sure you're serving all of the children and not just the squeaky wheels?
It's definitely a complicated, a very difficult part of special education or education as a whole. I mean, I think every teacher wants to do the very best for all the students, and the reality of public education, the resources are limited. So when we do meet with parents and they do have requests, absolutely every parent should advocate and fight for the best for their child. But I think it's the team's responsibility to work together to be the most realistic with the resources so that that child's able to be successful. And I think, you know, teachers and schools and teams have learned how to be very crafty with their resources, and certainly each try their very best to do what's best for the child. But I think open and honest conversations, when parents sometimes do come in with unrealistic what seem to be unrealistic expectations for the education system to uphold, I think that's important, where the team should have that trusting relationship and conversation to kind of come alongside that parent to educate them and help them understand what the reality of what we can implement for that child to be most successful. But hearing that parent and understanding where they're coming from, not discounting their what they believe will be the most beneficial for their child, helping them understand their child in this setting.
And what do you do if you flip that scenario on its head and you're dealing with a child who has special needs and you're clear as the educator about how to address those needs, mm-hmm. and you're following the plan, but you have parents who aren't available or don't care? Or what is the parent's responsibility in this case? Is there one?
Well, absolutely. Every parent has the responsibility to support their child, to support the school and the IEP and the process that's in place. The school system works very hard to keep all the parents actively involved in their child's learning, and so that they have the ability to speak up for their child, because they, first and foremost, should be their number one advocate. But there are situations where the parents are not able to be actively a part of the team, or choose not to be for whatever their reasons might be. And I think in that case, that's when the team we reach out and do as much as we can possibly do, but we can't make the parent follow through with certain, we make recommendations, we make sure we provide resources that the school system can offer to keep that parent involved so that they're educated about their child and what's in place. And then we work collaboratively with social workers to try to get those parents on board, because without their support, it is detrimental to their child.
We're talking about special education today on Coastline. Jeff from Jacksonville, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air. Hello, Jeff. All right, I guess we lost Jeff. We touched briefly on ABA therapy early on in this discussion. During our election season, when we were talking with candidates for school boards in both New Hanover and Brunswick counties, we had several parents call in and say, hey, is ABA therapy going to be available for my child who has autism in the school system? It's something that I've heard works. It's effective. We were never able to really answer those questions robustly. Amelia Moody, can you just explain what it is and how it works and what the efficacy of it is at this point and how it might fit into a public school setting? And Bethany, we'll ask you to chime in too.
Sure. ABA is applied behavioral analysis, so it's sort of a discrete trial method of instruction. It usually takes place in a one-to-one setting, and it's a big buzz because it is an evidence-based practice. However, schools have a number of other evidence-based effective methods for teaching children with autism. And so the challenge becomes, if a parent really wants this one particular therapy, does the school have the right to disagree and not provide that therapy, but provide an equal an equally effective therapy, and that's where the challenge comes in.
And is ABA therapy effective?
It is proven to be effective, and we know that from the research. We also know that implementing it in a classroom setting can be a challenge. So there's the best possible scenario, and then there's the reality with resources, as the previous caller talked about. We have educational cuts that have been happening over the past few years, and that really does affect the number of teachers and assistants that are available and the resources for the students. And so the question is, can those skills be taught with other methods? And I think Bethany probably has some ideas about this, but we try to meet the needs of children no matter what.
Bethany, nay?
Absolutely. I think that there's a variety of evidence-based practices that can be used with each child for them to be most successful, but when it using ABA so specifically, while we would, as a teacher, I would use that in my classroom one-to-one with a child, the reality is I would have to incorporate other strategies for them to be successful in a setting with other students in a classroom where there is one teacher or one teacher, maybe one assistant, and then there's several children. So the reality of implementing ABA with fidelity in a classroom with other children is not always the case. However, using those strategies to teach specific behaviors certainly would be utilized alongside other strategies so that the child can be most successful in that environment. So it's taking all those factors into consideration whenever you're developing the plan for having that child to be most successful. In a one-to-one therapy session, ABA may be the best fit for that child, but having to think about the environment they'll be in school, you have to take all those other things in consideration.
And Amelia Moody, you did a study looking at how students responded to an iPad versus a robot. Can you talk about that? What did you learn from that study?
Sure. So a few years back, we had students interact with simple games on an iPad versus simple games with a humanoid robot, which is a robot that looks human-like and has gestures and facial features that are somewhat similar to humans. And what we found was when they were playing the video games, their engagement was very, very high, as it was when they were playing games with the robot. But when it came to language and communication, there was much less language during the iPad game versus playing with the robot. So,
and what does that
And this
indicate?
Was in groups of children. So that indicates that if you're going to use any form of technology to engage students, I guess the goal would be to ensure that you're still keeping up those other skills. So for our students at that particular center, they were working on communication and social skills. And so by embedding that into the technology, they were able to keep both of those high versus having something that was fun and engaging, but not necessarily assisting them with their goals.
And so what does that mean then in terms of practical application in classrooms?
I think teachers have to be purposeful about how they're using technological tools in the classroom. Are we just using it to use it because it's cool and exciting, or are we using it because it's going to help educate our children? And so that takes a lot of thought in matching the skills that we're working on with the actual tool. And that is something that I appreciate researching because I want children to be excited about learning, but I also want it to be purposeful so that they can reach their potential.
So you can draw some conclusions about best practices through research, but Bethany Nay, it sounds like, and I think you even said at one point, that every single child is different.
Yes.
How do you do that? Do you take us through the process with a child? Let's make up a fictional child and how you come up with this learning program. Simple in 60 seconds, right?
There's the problem. It's not simple. I think, you know, as special education teachers, you have to be incredibly reflective and just kind of come alongside where that child is on their level, and then constantly collaborating with Dr. Moody, you know, experts in all these different areas with these different practices, and through trial and error to figure out what is the best tool that would make this child access their education across the board and make them the most interactive in a positive way, and just being very intentional with whatever you put in place and collecting data on that to see if it truly is effective or just entertaining to that child.
Well, that's this edition of Coastline. Amelia Moody, Bethany Ney, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Today's show was engineered by Caleb Covington. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes store. Join us for next week's Coastline when we begin a special series on alternate strategies for dealing with opioid addiction in our area. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.